And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
As I think most of you know, who've listened or read my work over the years, there are a handful of articles and podcasts that I feel represent information that will help investors make the most important decisions. They are important enough that I update them every year in the hopes that the newcomer will look at it as fresh information and not something that's out of date, and that the person who has been following it in the past will see it as an opportunity to renew the education. The articles and podcasts that I think have had the most impact are important today in my discussion about distributions. In fact, not just today, but in a couple of weeks, I'll do another piece on a different approach to distributions in retirement. And to the extent that you have not read the articles or listened to the podcasts from the previous discussions that lead up to this, in some ways, most important decision-making a process, part of the decision-making process, those pieces, the ultimate buy-and-hold portfolio or fine-tuning your asset allocation, these pieces speak to what equity asset classes I think you should have in your portfolio, whether you're a first-time investor or entering retirement. And then the fine-tuning discussion around how much should you have in equities and how much in fixed income. Huge decisions. For first-time investors, you can miss literally millions of dollars of lifetime income and growth by being too conservative. And in many cases, millennials are sitting entirely on fixed income. And there's a huge price likely to be paid by doing that. And then, of course, for the person who is close to or in retirement, being too aggressive, being all equities, which I find commonly, could be a step in the wrong direction. Because when we're in retirement, defense becomes so important. And you'll see that in the work that I'm about to discuss. So I do want to encourage those who have not read the information or listened to the podcast about the ultimate buy and hold strategy or the fine-tuning your asset allocation. Those are building blocks to what I consider to be the final huge decision that investors will make. So what I'm going to be speaking about in this podcast is about the process, the portfolio, how you build a portfolio at that point that you want to start paying yourself. This truly is a huge decision because you're quitting work. You lose the ability to have regular income. Now, many of you have the luxury of not only Social Security, but a pension that may meet most of your financial needs, in which case you have great latitude in what you might do with your money. But I think in more cases, and this is likely to be true as we go into the future, the people, investors, are not going to have the guarantee that makes it possible for them to just sit back and get their monthly check from the corporation or the government. And so these huge decisions need to be made. And I divide this discussion of distributions into trying to help people who are retiring with what I think, in terms of enough. They don't have extra. They have enough. And so they have to rely on cash flow out of whatever they've saved and that they have invested. They rely on that cash flow to meet their needs. And not only do they need it to meet their needs today in today's cost of living, but they need to have the ability to adjust that upward as inflation becomes has an impact on the portfolio and on your cost of living. That's what today is about, dealing with people who retire with enough. And in the coming podcast and article about distributions, we will address it for folks who have more than enough. And that's a whole different approach, theoretically, to how you might invest and how you might take money out of your portfolio. And it is my belief, having been an investment advisor for 30 years and having lived myself as a retiree, it is my belief that having oversaved can pay some amazing dividends in terms of peace of mind and in terms of being able to build a portfolio that in essence includes all of the kinds of defense that I know to protect an investor at the same time as they are growing in retirement their portfolio. I do struggle as to how to make this presentation without confusing the listener. I would love for you to be sitting right here across the table from me or on the same side of the table looking at these the tables of numbers that with the help of Daryl Balls we've put together to make hopefully this discussion as meaningful as possible. Now, the good news is we have over 40 tables of numbers. That's the good news. And I say it's the good news because it gives me an opportunity to show you a whole range of potential portfolios and levels of risk and different levels of distributions and dealing with inflation. All of these variables are here in these 40 plus tables. That's the good news. The bad news is I have 40 plus tables, and it is a challenge to figure out, okay, how can I give you enough information in this podcast to create the interest in knowing more? And so I'm going to focus on just a handful of those tables, and I'll spend on one particular table a lot of time, and then quickly take you to a few other tables. But I can tell you that the purpose of all of this is to create the curiosity and for you to see the possibilities in how you can build a portfolio. I think it's important to note that for the most of the people that I sense are going to use this information are people who are do-it-yourself investors. But I don't want the individual who's relying on an investment advisor, I don't want those people to miss the opportunity to learn some things that might help you in working with your advisor to get to that right combination, the combination that exposes you to the proper amount of risk and gives you the opportunity for a certain return. There is the ability, at least looking backwards, and I'm thinking about looking backwards to almost 90 years of data, to see how investing appears to work, how it can work for you, how it can work against you. And so I'm going to cherry pick a few tables that I think will set you up to be able to look beyond those few tables. There are some important things. In fact, let's go to table one. And if you haven't downloaded the tables, I hope you will. I think by simply listening without the tables, you'll get the idea. But it would be nice, because there are so many numbers, it would be nice to have you in a position to see those numbers and as I'm talking about them. In Table 1, you will see that in the headline it says, Very Conservative S&P 500 Fixed Distribution Schedule, and then in parens, $30,000. Very Conservative S&P 500 Fixed Distribution Schedule. What does that mean? This table of numbers is meant to show you the impact of a combination of retiring in 1970, using as the equity portion of your portfolio the S&P 500. That's it. No small cap, no international, no REITs, no emerging markets, just the S&P 500. And there is nothing wrong with that decision. And in fact, if you're thinking, well, what about the total market index? If you look back to 1928 and see the returns of the total market index and the S&P 500, they are virtually the same. So this S&P 500 and the total market index, it represents most of the value of public corporations in the United States. And as we know, many of those companies, not only are they're U.S. corporations, but they do business all over the world. And we have this wonderful database that has been created basically by the academic community, looking at by the way, hypothetical returns. When you go back to 1928, there was no S&P 500. What the academics have done is that they have actually created what would appear to be the S&P 500. We didn't have the S&P 500 itself until 1957. But these numbers on this table, Table 1, these numbers go back to 1970. And as you look at all of these columns, I just want you to know that if you looked at the fine-tuning table regarding the S&P 500 only, those are the numbers that were used to create this particular table. Now, this table reflects a whole bunch of different combinations of stocks and bonds. Whether you're looking at the fine-tuning table, where it's specifically the returns, or you're looking at this Table 1 Very Conservative S&P 500 Fixed Distribution Schedule, what you're looking at here is the combination of stocks, S&P 500, and bonds. And so you will see, one year at a time, if you establish a particular distribution strategy, purely mechanical, what you would have received, you know, theoretically, we can't, this is never going to happen again in the same way it happened. There's nothing on this page that you can say, okay, I'm going to put my money into that combination of stocks and bonds, and I believe that I will get these returns. No, you will not get these returns. And the reason I know you will not get these returns is because the market will not be the same. It may have all the same ups and downs as it did over this particular 48-year period, but they won't roll out the same way. For some of you, you will retire, and this is really just about luck. You will retire into a great bull market. Others of you will retire into a terrible bear market. And depending on what fate gives you, that is going to drive what your table will look like through the end of your life. All I'm doing this table for is to show you these relationships between risk and return, and inflation, and the impact of taking money out over time. And on this page, if you look at the far right-hand side, you will see that there is the inflation index, consumer prices from 1970 all the way through 2017. And if you just take a second and look at the unbelievable range of inflationary rates that we've lived with. I've lived through this whole period of time and a lot more. And I look back at 1970. In 1970, the CPI was 5.48%. But about 5 years later, it was 12. About 10 years later, it was 13. And then it went down and by 1989 to 4.6. And then by 2015, it was down to less than 1%. In fact, in 2008, it was 0.09, broke even almost in terms of inflation. That was a terrible time for our economy, as I'm sure you remember. And the reason that is there is because as you retire, you're going to have a particular cost of living, and the idea is for the portfolio to support that cost of living. But if the cost of living is going to go up almost every year for the rest of your life, you would like your portfolio to be adjusted to that. And in fact, if you look at the column right next to the CPI, the second column from the right, it's headed distribution. And you'll see that in this particular table, there is a first-year distribution out of an investment of $1 million of $30,000, or 3% of that original amount that you had to invest. Now, when I put the title, Very Conservative, at the top here, that very conservative was not about the S&P 500. Because the S&P 500 is not conservative. It can have a year that it loses half of your money. I don't call that conservative. This very conservative in the title, that is addressing how much we're asking this portfolio to pay us each year. There, I saw one survey that said that something like 30% of retirees are taking out 7% or more of their portfolio in retirement. And in most cases, that's because they have to. They don't have enough that they could take out and live on 3%. And what you'll see on this table, and the end result will be, hey, taking out 3% of the original amount of money that I start with and adjusting it for inflation each year, looks like it's going to work out. The probabilities of success are quite high. And this table, even to make it better for most of us retirees, this table has 48 years of performance in terms of returns, and 48 years of distributions. And if you were to adjust that original $30,000 every year by the inflation that actually happened, according to the U.S. government, there are those who say that, in fact, inflation was higher than what the U.S. government reported, but that's what we have to work with here. You will see that the first year's distribution was $30,000, and when you go all the way to the bottom of the page, in 2017, adjusting for the inflation over that 48 years, you would need to take out $192,852 to replicate the buying power of the $30,000 in 1970. That just doesn't feel right, but that's the impact of compounding. You are going to be blown away in many cases, I think, as we go through this presentation about what compounding does to people, whether it's good compounding, which is losing money and compounding it, or bad compounding where you're losing, or good compounding where you're gaining. You're going to see the impact of both. Now, right next then to the distribution column is a column headed S&P 500. That is going to be the underlying equity asset class, as I said before, and that column reflects the impact of the S&P 500 on the retirement portfolio if the investor had it entirely in stocks. And you'll see that you start with $1 million, and at the end of the very first year, you took out $30,000, and by the way, in these tables, the money is taken out at the beginning of the year, not monthly, not quarterly, not at the end of the year, but at the beginning of the year. We had to make a choice. That's the way my wife and I take out money from our retirement account. We take it out at the first of the year so we know what we have for the year. We don't have to worry about the market going up and down to access our money. But I can tell you that had you taken the money out monthly instead of at the first of the year, the final number at the bottom of the page would be higher. Or if you took it out, you know, let's say you saved an extra pot of money, didn't mix it in with the rest of your money, your investments, and you build it up so that it covered the first year's contributions so that you didn't have to dip into the million. So you took your first distribution at the end of the year instead of the first of the year. It's a lot more money at the end of this 48 years. But the assumption here is take the money at the first of the year. Now you'll notice under that 100% stock portfolio, you'll notice compare what you had at the end of the first year with the S&P 500, you had $1,009,052. But if you invested the way that we're recommending and you invested in what I'll call the real world, you would have paid an expense ratio. And instead of making $9,052, remember, that's after taking out the $30,000 at the first of the year, you would have made $9,052 without any expenses, but we applied 0.1% to the expenses, which you can get an S&P 500, a mutual fund, or ETF, for less than 0.1%. And instead of making $9,052, you made $8,045 at the end of the year. Now, I want you to see something interesting. When you go all the way over to the left of the page and you look at the column that says 100% bonds, bonds did better that year than stocks did, made more money. And so instead of ending up with $1,008,000, you ended up with $1,113,000. It was a better year to be in bonds than it was to be in the stock market. Now, what conclusion would you make if your decision was all stocks or all bonds? At the end of that year, you might have had a sense that, well, you know, maybe bonds really are better. Maybe the long-term history of stocks doing better than bonds, maybe that's over. Bonds are the place to be. Well, you have no idea where you're going to be 20 years from that point, or 40 years from that point, or all the way to the bottom of the page. If we go all the way to the bottom of the page, we see the 100% bonds, after taking out this money every year, the first of each year, adjusted for inflation, that under the bond portfolio, 100% bonds, you end up with about $4.5 million. And by the way, you took out distributions, and you can go over to the right side, way at the bottom of the page, it says total distributions, $5,364,000. So you took out over $5 million, and you were left, your heirs were left with $4.5 million. Now, there are no taxes taken into consideration here. I always believe that when you're doing your budget, that taxes are just a part of the budget. So when I conclude that you could live on $30,000, probably plus Social Security, I'm assuming that that includes the cost of taxes in that budget. But started with $1 million, took out $5.3 million, and ended with $4.5 million, and almost every year was better than the next, all bonds. If we look at the 100% stock portfolio, S&P 500, less the 0.1%, instead of ending with $4.5 million, yes, you take out the same $5.4 million, but the bottom line number, if you look at it in 2017, is $33.2 million. 8 times almost more money to leave to others if you lived for 48 years. But let's not talk about 48 years. Let's talk about living 10 years for the sake of discussion. In fact, I think as you look at these tables, when you have the time to do it without me yapping away, I hope that you'll look at every decade and see what it would have been like. Try to relive and believe that you had no idea what was coming after that decade. But look at the 100% stock portfolio. At the end of 1979, you have $1,174,000. If you'd had all your money in 100% bonds, you would have had $1,406,000. So there's 10 years worth of data that could give you the feeling, the trust more in bonds than you might the stock market. But there's another number on this page that I just think is so important. When I look at the 100% stock portfolio, I look at what you had at the end of 1974. It was down to $757,000. How do you think you'd be feeling about the security of your financial future at that point? Are you thinking that that maybe you made a big mistake counting on the stock market? Well, this is the stock market. This is the way it works when it works right. It has periods it goes up, it had periods it goes down, and the losses of 73 and 74 are almost the same as the losses from 2000 to 2002, almost the same as the losses from 2007 through 2008, and on an inflation-adjusted basis, not so different than the losses that were sustained from 1929 to 1932. Performance in the past must be, you must investigate the bad times as well as the bottom line good times that make you feel so good. You're not going to feel good. By the way, you may be able to take it going down to $757,000 by the end of 1974, but I want to know about your spouse. How would they be feeling? Now, fortunately, the choices aren't just all in bonds or all in stocks. There's another column here. In fact, there are a whole bunch of columns that represent combinations of stocks and bonds. I want to focus on the 50-50, half in stocks and half in bonds. I want you to see that at the end of the first year, 1970, yes, you would have been better all in bonds, but you did end up in the 50-50 category with $1,063,000. And when 1974 came along and it just tore people apart, not only financially but emotionally, I want you to notice that that portfolio went down to $993,000 at the end of 1974. And I don't mean to suggest that your only risk is to lose a few thousand dollars. No, there's lots of examples on this page that would show you that it got worse than that. But there's defense built into that bond portion of the portfolio, and the 50-50 is kind of half defense and half offense. And you can see, if you go all the way to the bottom of the page, that you ended up with an extra $17 million in the 50-50 column. But you would never, at the end of that first decade, have had any sense that that could happen to you. Where there just wasn't anything in that first 10 years that gave you a sense that you were on your way to hitting a home run if you live long enough. But I look at the next decade, from 1980 to 1989, and I see at the end of that decade, the portfolio is up to $2.6 million for the 100% bonds. With the 50-50, it's $3.5 million, and with the 100% in stocks, $3.7 million. So you could say, well, those who were willing to be all in stocks, they got paid for that risk. But I've sat with a lot of people when I was in the business as an advisor for over 30 years. And I still, from time to time, talk with friends about their situation. I can tell you, I don't meet very many retired people that are willing to lose 25 or 50% of their money as a 100% stock portfolio would expose you to. Some are willing. And the reason they are willing is because they have enough in Social Security and their pensions to meet their cost of living. They are saving the money for the next generation. Now, if you go one more decade with me, the 1990 through 1999, with the all bonds, you go from $2.7 million at the end of 89 to $3.8 million at the end of 1999. So you continued to grow a little bit more than what you paid out because you used this very conservative payout distribution schedule. The 50-50 strategy, by that point at the 1999, end of 99, you've got $9.2 million. If you were all in equities, you had almost $16 million. So this table is my best attempt to show you a very long period of time. In a couple of years, we'll be able to say we've got 50 years worth of data, and maybe people will believe it more or take it more seriously than with just 48 years of data. But it doesn't look all that different if you go back to 1928. And we'll be doing that, by the way. You'll have that in the future. So this is not an illogical equity asset class to use. You don't need internationals. You don't need small cap, any significant exposure to small cap. You don't need to overweight the portfolio to value. There's a lot of things you don't need to do. You don't need REITs. You don't need emerging markets. You could just do this with the S&P 500. And if you use a very conservative distribution strategy, and I look at every one of these columns going to the bottom of the page, it gives me a sense of trust that could happen. But there are people who don't or can't live on 3% distribution. In fact, most of us in the industry grew up believing that a 4% distribution was a very conservative strategy. And if you go with me to table two, now table two we have the conservative, not the very conservative, but the conservative distribution strategy using only the S&P 500. And instead of taking out 30,000, we're going to take out 40,000. That is the only change. Same stocks, same bonds. By the way, those bonds there, that's a U.S. government intermediates. Oh, and I forgot to tell you something else that I think is important. We fully loaded the portfolio with expenses. The database we use comes from Dimensional Funds. And we applied the expenses going back to 1970 to the indexes that you would pay today if you were in DFA. And by the way, DFA funds are more expensive, slightly more expensive than Vanguard funds. So we've tried to be realistic in building this table. That doesn't make it more real, because we don't know what real is in the future. But it at least loads it up with some expenses. What we haven't included is a management fee, because this is basically for the do-it-yourself investor. So when we look at the conservative strategy, the same 100% bonds through 100% stocks, and we took out the $40,000 instead of $30,000 by taxing the portfolio by $10,000 more, and then increasing it each year by the inflation rate, you can see a little white area down here at the bottom of this table. That white area is where you ran out of money. Now, you may say, look, I'm not living for 48 years. I'm 74. I can say it. I can face reality. I am not living for another 48 years. So I could look at 20 years, possibly. Unlikely. I haven't been as kind to my body as many other people I know have. But, okay, I can look out and see from 1970 through 1989... that I would have done okay, taking out the $40,000 a year. Then I can go over to the 50-50 and see that over 20 years I would have done okay. I would have gone through one bad decade and then a much better decade, and I would have done okay. If I want to really punish myself, I could look at the decade from 1970 to 1979, where at the end of the decade you end up with about 15% more than you started with, the $1,148,000. Then I could pretend the next decade would look like, let's say, 2000 through 2009. They call that the lost decade. You may remember that. And you started with $3.9 million and you ended with $2.8 million. So it would make me believe that it would probably last for 20 years if you had two bad decades in a row. This is not the table, by the way, I would be willing to say that it's the answer for my financial future. I will share that with you in a few minutes. But for people who don't live a long time, you're probably okay taking out the $40,000 or 4% of whatever your original amount is and adjusting it for inflation. But I want you to remember, if you think in terms of that one, what might be perceived small change going from $30,000 to $40,000, when I think back at what I had at the bottom of the 48-year period when I was 50-50, $17.8 million. And when I look at the 50-50 on table two, I'm left with $2.5 million. That change cost you the difference between $17 million plus versus $2.5. So that decision, how much you take out of a portfolio, particularly if you're a young retiree, and when I ask college students out of a room of 50 college students, I'll ask how many of you would like to retire by the time you're 50, more than half of the hands go up. When I was 50, I was just getting started working. I loved what I did. Still do, by the way. Then I look over at the column that's headed 100% stocks. As we know, that's the S&P 500. You will notice at the bottom of the page, you're left with $5.4 million versus $33 million in table one. I mean, it is a huge, huge difference taking out 3% and taking out 4%. But for most people, you probably would have made it if you weren't going to live a long time. And if you don't get caught with two bad decades in a row, historically, not likely, but could happen. Never know. Just don't know. So let me show you two other columns. You're probably not going to believe this. I didn't when I first saw it, but it's just the impact of compounding. And the rate that you're taking money out. But look at the 100% stock portfolio return at the end of 48 years and the S&P 500. The S&P 500, 7.1 million versus 5.4 million. The difference between those two columns is 0.1%. Expense ratio that we applied to the S&P 500. So now I think you got the idea how to use these 40-plus tables. The idea is for you, first of all, if I had the time to sit with you, and I don't do this anymore, but I would go through the fine-tuning table and make sure that you understood the historical risk and potential return for the particular allocation that you end up using. There's a reason why my wife and I are 50-50. We could be 100% in bonds, no problem. But we have things we want that money to do, not for us to get by for the rest of our life, but for children and charities after we're gone. A lot of people want to die broke. I'll show you how to do that in just a few minutes. But the bottom line is that each one of these columns represents a certain level of risk, and some great times when the market's up, and depending on the amount of equity, some horrific times when the market is down. And my belief is I'm looking for a way to help people find the best unit of return per unit of risk and to have peace of mind. Now I have one more S&P 500 table here that I want to refer to. It's table 3. Table 3 ought to be a shocker because all we're going to do is take out 50,000 instead of 40,000. And you will see column after column, every column runs out of money mid-1990s. You are moving in with the kids. Or, by the way, what will really more than likely happen is you will adjust your lifestyle. I don't think somebody is going to sit there and watch their investments go from $1 million down to $500,000 and not figure out a way to get by for the rest of your life. Let me tell you what a person like that might do, because there is an answer for a lot of people who really don't get this whole process and don't have a sense that they can make the right decisions. And that is to put enough money in a immediate life annuity. It's the equivalent of a pension. That's all it is. It's the equivalent of somebody saying, I guarantee to pay you $500 a month for the rest of your life. That is a legitimate answer. Because right now, somebody my age would probably get, I don't know, on $1 million, I'd get $70,000. On $500,000, I'd get $35,000. Maybe more. For both my wife and myself, on a second to die annuity. A lot of you probably are thinking about turning the machine off right now because I use the word annuity and you don't believe in insurance products. And yet when I sit with people like you, you would believe in a pension, but you wouldn't believe in an annuity. You love the pension, but you hate the annuity. An annuity is the same as a pension, a guarantee, not by the government, by the way. And for some people, it's the right thing to do. But just like I want you, when you are investing in mutual funds, to be in low expenses, massive diversification, index funds that are in your are built in your best interest, not the salesperson. And the same goes with annuities. There are ways, the right ways to buy annuities that are in your best interest, and there are god-awful bad ways that you could invest in annuities because of the commissions can be very, very high. Don't have to pay those high commissions. Anyway, you see how you could go broke? Taking out what might appear to be a reasonable amount of money. Remember when I said that something like 30% of people who are retired are taking out more 7% or more to live on? You can see the problem that they have. So now you've seen a series of tables. I've got tables that go up to 6%. Well, you know what the 6% table is going to look like. It's going to look worse. Oh, and let me try to entice you into listening to the podcast in a couple of weeks that's about variable distributions, because I'm going to show you a way to take out that $5,000 from that original investment and take that $50,000 on a million and not run out of money at the bottom of the page. I hope you'll join me on that one, because I think you'll like the outcome. But now it's time to look at a different set of tables. I want you to look at tables 10, 11, and 12. Now, the only thing that's going to change here is the selection of the equity asset classes. Same intermediate bonds, same combinations of some percentage of bonds with some percentage of equities. Same distribution, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. The only difference is we're going to build a portfolio that includes big and small companies, value and growth, U.S. and international, slice of emerging markets when they were available, slice of REITs. You're going to have 10 times, actually more like 20 to 30 times more companies in your portfolio. And it won't be comfortable for everybody, because they're not comfortable having half of their equities in internationals. Now, I'm not going to talk about them on this particular podcast, but in that 40 plus tables, you'll see tables for the combination of 70% in equities, U.S. equities, and 30% international. So you can see how the returns, by the way, are very similar. What really makes the difference on this page is the addition of the small and value. So, table 10. Very conservative. There's that term again. It's not about the equity portion we're saying very conservative. It's about the rate of distribution, starting with $30,000. And under the 100% stock portfolio, you'll see that it does fall, just like the S&P 500 fell in 73 and 74. But in fact, the lowest number at the end of 1974 was 867,000, whereas in table three, it got down to, I'm sorry, table one, I'm going back here, hang on with me for a second, it was 757,000. So this additional diversification helped. And there's a lot I could say about this table. I could go through it kind of line by line like I did on the S&P 500, but I think you've got the rhythm. I'm hoping that you do. But there are some things that I think are worth noting. First of all, We could have all of our money in the U.S. rather than 500 stocks in the S&P 500. We could choose to find our favorite company and just invest in one company. There was a time when General Motors was the company. As goes General Motors, so goes the country, they said. And it turned out that the country survived better than the company did. But no, I like the 500 if you're going to go with one particular investment. On the other hand, I like the idea of having a combination of all of these different asset classes, because there are times that, you know, they ebb and flow, and that diversification just smooths out the volatility. 100% stocks is still 100% stocks. I don't care if you've got 15,000 stocks in your portfolio, you're still sitting on losing half of your money during a bear market, a severe bear market. And we've had three of those since the 70s. But I want you to look in particular at the period 2000 through 2009. You started at the end of 1999, you had in the 100% stock portfolio, you had about $39 million. And by the end of that decade, what they called the lost decade, you had about twice as much money. And that's because the combination of international and value and small, those things that you added to the S&P 500, did okay. Now, if we talk just in terms of our kind of our wildest dreams, what might we be worth when we're 100? Well, I can look at least at 48 years, and I do know this, that the 48 years in the 100% bonds is going to look exactly the same as the previous tables because it's the same bonds. But when I look at the 50-50 table, I can see that with the 50-50, I ended up with about $17-plus million with the S&P 500. And here, with this worldwide diversification approach, you end the 50-50 with about almost $46 million. You distribute the same $5.4 million. Didn't change that. You're still going to take out, start with $30,000 and increase it every year by inflation. But you'll notice that the 100% stock portfolio ends up here with $172 million versus with table one, $33 million. Six times as much money. It's just the power of compounding. It is hard to believe, truly. It is hard to believe what time and reasonable returns. This is not like Warren Buffett returns here. These returns are, I think, a couple percent better than the S&P 500 in the equity portion of the portfolio. And again, the bonds are just the same. So I'm attracted to this, not because I think that a million will turn into 46 million and that you'll get to take out 5.4 million. I'm attracted because overall I've got exposure to more. You know, I don't care if one is either is or isn't a Trump supporter, but the things that he's doing in our economy bothers some people. I mean, the possibility of a trade war that's not a pretty picture, at least based on history. And so I am sure there are people who are, even though they say when the U.S. catches a cold, sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. Yes, I know that is a risk, but it is possible that other countries, value companies, smaller companies will potentially do better than just the S&P 500 on its own. I trust that to be the future, but I don't know that. And that's one of the challenges. I trust that stocks will do better than bonds. I don't know that. I trust that value will be better than growth. I don't know that. I just trust that it will. I trust there will be a future. What's more difficult is to try to determine how much longer I'm likely to live. I have much greater trust that I'll be around, that small will do better than large, than that I'll be around in 20 years. So we all have to, to wrestle with these different things that we have to trust. So all the same lessons are in here. How badly these particular combinations perform. Well, for example, if I look at the 1974 end result in the 50-50 under the table 10, I see that in 1974 you actually had more money at the end of that year than when you started. And that's not true with the S&P 500 only. You had less than a million at the end of 1974. So this is one more combination where we can also look at what happens when you go from very conservative to conservative and take out 40,000. And there's still a little white at the bottom of the table. Oh, I think it's time to talk about that difference. Notice how you go from 100% bonds on table 11. 100% bonds runs out of money in 2008. It's gone. In 2008, if you had just 10% of your money in equities, you would have ended the year with over $2 million. So in 2007, with 100% bonds, you end the year with about $34,000 versus $2 million for adding 10% in equities, and $4.6 million when you add 20%. And if you only went that far, those of you who were so super conservative, if you just loaded the portfolio with 20% in equities, I think it will pay some pretty substantial bonus for having taken what I consider to be a relatively small amount of risk. And then if you compared the 20% equity to the 100% bonds in Table 11, and you looked at the end of each decade to see how did you do, well, in each case, you came you were ahead by having that 20% equities. Again, we come back to that word of trust. Because I've seen people who I've tried to get to put 20% in equities, and the fact that that 20% went down in a bear market was enough to wipe them out emotionally, even if they were financially still okay because they had 80% in bonds. So you can look at table 11. You notice that the 50-50 strategy leaves you at the end of the 48 years with almost $27 million. The 100% stock portfolio, almost $126 million. And right there is the S&P 500 without the 0.1% taken out, but it's close versus $7 million with the S&P. And that happens because the additional diversification created defense that you couldn't get with the S&P 500. And over time, it builds and builds. Good defense is as important as good offense. And inflation can be a tough thing to overcome. And that's why you need at least some equity in the portfolio. And then if we go to table 12, we see a lot of white area, but remember with the S&P 500, there was a ton of white. In fact, everything was white from the 90s on. And here, at least, most of the columns. Now, the unfortunate thing is the columns that have all the money in them are the columns that retirees probably shouldn't be in because they're too risky. But the premium has been huge. But I would say that 40, 50, and 60% equity, when I was in the business, that's where most of the retirement money sat. And you can see why. And by the way, my clients and my old firm's clients still, this worldwide strategy is the strategy that we built on over 30 years while I was there, and they continue the commitment. But when I compare the S&P 500 here to running out of money in about 1992 or 3, and I look at the 100% stock portfolio going on to leave our children and charities potentially a lot of money, I think it's exciting. The potential. Final three tables that I'm going to look at are tables 19, 20, and 21. I want to make it very clear that what I'm about to share with you here shows some amazing returns that may not be life-changing for you, but it certainly could be life-changing for your heirs. And it is using this all-value strategy, and instead of having a diversification between big and small value and growth, big and small value and growth, both U.S. and international, that this portfolio does the U.S. international, does the big and small, but it focuses on value rather than growth. And, you know, to overly simplify it, it's kind of the Warren Buffett way of investing, but with massive diversification. The problem is for most of us, including myself, it's not something I grew up with. It's not something I experienced over decades. In a way, I show these tables to younger people, maybe people even in their 20s, to say, look, if you consider having an all-value portfolio, and the ups and downs are not that different from the ups and downs of the overall market. And in fact, it's amazing how close to what you would experience with the S&P 500 the all-value portfolio produces historically. But the people who it might apply to are the people who are younger, who if they start with an all-value portfolio, maybe not their whole portfolio, but a major portion of it, that potentially they could go into retirement and they could have it be a part, a major part of their retirement. A person might end up putting 50% of their money in a worldwide diversified, and 50% of their money in all value. I mean, there's all many different ways it could be applied. And at this point, since I've spent so much time with you, taking you through all of these years and decades, I think you know how to look at it. The bonds are the same bonds we had before. But instead of showing the S&P 500 or the worldwide, the 100% stock is represented by large and small value, U.S. and international, and a slice of emerging markets, small slice, plus this certain amount of fixed income. And if you go to the bottom line numbers are amazing. Whether you go out 48 years or you go out 30 years, and you compare them to the other tables, it is an amazing difference. But it's the power of compounding. This idea that with $365 a year from birth to age 65 can turn into $2 million without doing anything, in fact, $4 million potentially without doing anything remarkable, comes because of time and compounding. So you can see the bottom line with the 50-50 is 53.7 million. With 100% stocks, 226.7 million. And even if you cut these numbers in half, by the way, that would be true, certainly, of the $30,000 distribution rate. If you cut these numbers in half, they would still be good numbers in terms of what you'd be able to leave to others. And when I go from table 19 to table 20, what we see is that, remember, the bonds are going to run out of money, but most everything gets to the bottom of the page with lots of money left over. And that's with the $40,000. And when you look at the $50,000, again, a lot of columns don't get to the bottom of the page. So what do we know here? What have we learned, I guess? I think first and foremost, it's all about defense, I mean, virtually all about defense in terms of survivorship. And that defense comes with diversification amongst as many asset classes that have a long history of success as you can access, that you keep your expenses low, that you find that right balance of fixed income and equity. And this page really is, these pages are more in this distribution part of the discussion, having to do with looking at the impact of taking money out. Just a couple weeks ago, we talked about accumulating money over many years, $1,000 a year over 48 years. What does that do to you? Then what does that $1 million that's legitimate for anybody in their 20s, if they'll accept equities into their portfolio and do it right, they are likely to have that $1 million. That's not an impossibility. But you can see that the combination of equity and fixed income, it impacts you on the way up as you accumulate. And boy, does it impact you on the way down when you're taking distributions. And how much you take out, and how much you have in fixed income, and then how much you have in equity. All of those things lead to a return that is under your control in terms of expenses, asset classes, distribution rates. All of those things are in your control. What I can't control, what you can't control, what nobody can control is what inflation will be, what the bad times will look like, whether they'll come early in your retirement or late. But I can tell you that with proper diversification, you can address almost all of those hurdles. And I think for most of you, even though you're do-it-yourselfers, I think that's great. Boy, these decisions are so important that I hope you'll spend a few bucks and pass them by a professional who could take a look at your situation. I hope you'll do that. I hope these tables have been useful. There are lots more to look at, and I hope that you will send lots of questions on this topic, because I suspect that I'll do a couple of podcasts just on responding to your Q&As. Thanks for listening. If you've got a friend who's coming up to retirement, you just send him to paulmerriman.com, alert him to what we call best advice. If he will just read the articles and look at the tables and listen to the podcasts under that best advice and trying to help a do-it-yourselfer, I think that's the best work that we do and will hopefully make a huge difference on your financial future. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.